The reading this morning is taken from Luke chapter 15, verses 11 to 24, and it's on page 1049 in the Church Bibles. Jesus continued, "There was a man who had two sons. The younger one said to his father, 'Father, give me my share of the estate.' So he divided his property between them. Not long after that, the younger son got together all he had, set off for a distant country, and there squandered his wealth in wild living. After he had spent everything, there was a severe famine in that whole country, and he began to be in need. So he went and hired himself out to a citizen of that country, who sent him to his fields to feed pigs. He longed to fill his stomach with the pods that the pigs were eating, but no one gave him anything. When he came to his senses, he said, 'How many of my father's hired servants have food to spare? And here I am, starving to death. I will set out and go back to my father and say to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me like one of your hired servants.' So he got up and went to his father. But while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and was filled with compassion for him. He ran to his son, threw his arms around him and kissed him. The son said to him, 'Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son.' But the father said to his servants, 'Quick, bring the best robe and put it on him. Put a ring on his finger and sandals on his feet. Bring the fattened calf and kill it. Let's have a feast and celebrate, for this son of mine was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found.' So they began to celebrate."
Thank you, Sally. Okay, good to see you all. Good to be back. Nice to see so many people here and new faces for me anyway. So it's good to be returning, but also going to be in a different setting. So thanks for that. And thanks for everyone for everything you've done so far in this service. So we are looking at a number of themes today, but I guess the principal one is about the whole idea of the fall and foolishness and the concept of being foolish. And the story that that Sally just read to us, that parable which of the prodigal son, which is such a familiar Bible story, many people will recognize that story, in a sense encapsulates all that there is about the consequences of foolishness, but also the possibility of redemption. So there's a foolish action that results in dire consequences, but there's also, at the end of it, that sense of the possibility of redemption. And that is the kind of the theme, I think, for what we're looking at this morning. In the book of Proverbs, of course, there are many references to fools and foolish actions. I'll just give you a few from chapter 17. We have, "A discerning man keeps wisdom in view, but a fool's eyes wander to the ends of the earth. A foolish son brings grief to his father and bitterness to the one who bore him. A man of knowledge uses words with restraint, and a man of understanding is even-tempered. Even a fool is thought wise if he keeps silent, and discerning if he holds his tongue. A fool's lips brings him strife, and his mouth invites a beating. A fool's mouth is his undoing, and his lips are a snare to his soul." There are loads of these proverbs about the fool, about being foolish, about the consequences of foolish action, what fools bring upon themselves. And many, many of those proverbs are the proverbs of Solomon. And all of those were from Solomon himself. And Solomon, or King Solomon, was renowned for his wisdom. The wisdom of Solomon is still a phrase that is used now to reflect that kind of notion, that idea of real discernment, of real wisdom that has depth and meaning to it. Solomon is the representation, I guess, of that real kind of sort of deep wisdom in life. And in many respects, that wisdom that he had was God-given. So Solomon, as the son of King David, came to power on David's death. And there are other stories about how he came to power. It's not a pretty one. There are all kinds of things that happen in the Old Testament where you read it and go, that was a bit Old Testament-y. And there's certainly kind of things around the way in which he became king, which I guess are difficult to comprehend. But he was chosen to be king, and he moved into his kingship. And at the point when he was pronounced king and he was setting himself up as king, in the book of 1 Kings, chapter 3, it says this: "And God came to Solomon and said, 'Ask for whatever you want me to give you.'" Wow, I mean, that's quite something, isn't it? And already, I mean, we have myths and fables and fairy stories about the idea of some genie or somebody coming and saying, "You can have three wishes, or you can have something, you can have whatever you want. What might it be?" But for Solomon, that was a reality. God came to him at the beginning of his reign and said, "Ask for whatever you want me to give you." A bit risky on God's part as well, you might think. What would Solomon ask for? Solomon answered, "You have shown great kindness to your servant, my father David, because he was faithful to you and righteous and upright in his heart. You have continued this great kindness to him and have given him a son to sit on the throne this very day. Now, O Lord my God, you have made your servant king in place of my father David, but I am only a little child and do not know how to carry out my duties. Your servant is here among the people you have chosen, a great people, too numerous to count or number. So give your servant a discerning heart to govern your people and to distinguish between right and wrong. For who is able to govern this great people of yours?" And the Lord was pleased that Solomon had asked for this and said, "I will give you a wise and discerning heart so that there will never have been anyone like you, nor will there ever be." And true enough, from then on in, you have King Solomon, who is, if you like, the paragon of wisdom. And he makes these judgments, these discernments of over difficult situations, like two women over a kind of a child that they have a dispute over, those kind of things. And the wisdom of Solomon is displayed for the whole world. And that wisdom brings people from the world to see him. So the Queen of Sheba, for example, great example of someone who comes because she has heard of the great wisdom of Solomon. And even though he had that wisdom, of course, even though he is the author of so many proverbs and wise sayings about foolishness and fools, God gave him that wisdom, but it was hard for him to hold on to it. And that is, I guess, the story as well of kings in the Old Testament. So few of them, even though they were given greatness, managed to hold on to that greatness. And Solomon, in many respects, did have everything, because he was pronounced king of Israel. He was the son of King David, perhaps the most revered and kind of recognized king. He was made wealthy beyond imagination. He had absolute power as king, and he had purpose, because it was given to him to build the temple. David couldn't fulfill that task because he failed God. So it fell to Solomon to perform this sacred task of building God's temple. So he had wealth, he had power, he had status, he had purpose, he had meaning in his life, and he had wisdom. Wisdom beyond anything that anybody else had. So there's no wonder that Solomon could produce those proverbs to deride the fool and the foolish. But sadly, it didn't stay that way. So we read in 1 Kings chapter 11. "King Solomon, however, loved many foreign women besides Pharaoh's daughter: Moabites, Ammonites, Edomites, Sidonians, and Hittites. They were from nations about which the Lord had told the Israelites, 'You must not intermarry with them, because they will surely turn your hearts after their gods.' Nevertheless, Solomon held fast to them in love. He had, hold on to your hats here. He had 700 wives of royal birth and 300 concubines. That's 1,000 women. I could add that up, by the way. As his wives led him astray, and as Solomon grew old, his wives turned his heart after other gods, and his heart was not fully devoted to the Lord his God, as the heart of David his father had been. He followed Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Sidonians, and Molech, the detestable god of the Ammonites. So Solomon did evil in the eyes of the Lord. He did not follow the Lord completely as David his father had done. On a hill east of Jerusalem, Solomon built a high place for Chemosh, the detestable god of Moab, and for Molech, the detestable god of the Ammonites. He did the same for all his foreign wives who burned incense and offered sacrifices to their gods. What a mess. All that Solomon had, including that wisdom, did not prevent him from acting utterly foolishly. In a way that he turned from God and he allowed himself. So he would have known. He would have known what was expected of him. It wasn't that he drifted into that sin. It wasn't as though he was ignorant of what God expected of him. It was made clear by God about what was expected of all of the people, and even more so because he was the king. So wise, and yet capable of making such foolish decisions. And you begin to think, well, what hope is there for anyone? If someone like Solomon, who was given everything, every possibility, every kind of thing to help him kind of rule, including showing a discernible point, real wisdom in asking for more wisdom and being given it and blessed by God. If all the makings of that perfection he was unable to fulfill, how can any of us actually achieve anything remotely like a wise life? And ultimately for Solomon, it did result in disaster because by the end of his life, he was hounded by his enemies. And God had told him, this will not end well for you and will not end well for your sons. And the kingdom was broken up after Solomon. So there were consequences, there were implications to his foolish and rash actions, which were basically selfish actions, that he couldn't commit himself to God in the way that was expected. He really didn't live up to his own proverbs, to his own wisdom. He didn't sustain what God was expecting from him. Now that was old covenant. That was Old Testament. And when Jesus came to fulfill what had been given by God in the Old Testament, and he came to live up to the commands that God had given. And here was someone that perhaps could live a perfect life. And what's interesting about in Jesus' teaching, Jesus actually doesn't teach a great deal about foolishness and fools. Whereas in Proverbs you have this scattering, and Ecclesiastes you have these as well, but also throughout the Old Testament, there's this derision and this condemnation of fools and foolishness. And Jesus actually says a lot less about kind of the fools and foolishness. And if you think about kind of sort of sermons and teachings of Jesus that give us a grounding, a foundation of faith, perhaps the one that's known mostly is the Sermon on the Mount, as it's called. That kind of time when Jesus says, you have heard it said, or I will teach you. And it is often Jesus coming before people and saying, you're used to one thing. I'm now going to present something else to you. This is now the beginning of a new covenant. Yes, I'm here to fulfill the commands and the laws of God, what you have heard. But I'm also here to present something else to you. Something that may turn things around, even turn things on their head and difficult to grasp. And in his teaching, there's very little in the way of condemnation for the foolish. And in fact, in that sermon that he gives, he says this: you have heard that it was said to the people long ago, do not murder. And anyone who murders will be subject to judgment. But I tell you that anyone who is angry with his brother will be subject to judgment. Again, anyone says to his brother, Raca, is answerable to the Sanhedrin. But anyone who says, you fool, will be in danger of the fire of hell. Oh. this is a bit different, isn't it? People are going, we're used to proverbs and sayings that say, you fool. And the foolish are to be condemned. The foolish are apart from God. Those who are fools are to be derided and condemned. And here is Jesus saying, if you call someone a fool, you're in trouble. If you pronounce your brother to be a fool, then you will answer for that. And this is the beginning of Jesus changing and bringing kind of new life, a new word that was difficult probably for people to hear. And we know that. And it also can be difficult at times for us to hear. But it shifts the emphasis. Things are starting to change. And the message about what it means to be foolish is also changing. So we have to grasp that ourselves. Now the message that the story he gave about the prodigal son is a story of foolishness indeed. Because you have a situation, as Jesus describes, of someone who takes a risk, who makes a step in the wrong direction, but then risks it becoming worse and worse and worse. And that is the nature of foolishness. Yesterday, great sun, good weather, so Sue and I went for another walk. We're doing a lot of coastal walking at the moment. We're completing now the section between Severnbridge and Minehead. That's what we're doing on the coast there, so we're along that. So yesterday we were down near Hinkley Point, that beauty spot, on the Stirrup Marsh around there. And there's a walk that we could do from Hinkley Point coming round to the end of the kind of sort of the River Parrot to Bridgewater Bay. Now, when we do these walks, we don't really like doubling back on ourselves, but it's quite difficult to do when you park the car one place and you've got to get back to the car. So we did this nice walk, and I have my OS map with me. I like an OS map. It's quite an old OS map, which turns out to be a bit of a problem. And I said to Sue, we can get back to the car without having to double back on ourselves. We can make it a circular walk, right? Because on the map here, look, if we go up there, there are footpaths that go through there. So let's take this route. So we decided we would do that. And off we get going. And we come to a point where you're going, well, the map says there's a footpath here. There is a footpath, so we go through it. And then you come to another point where you're going, well, according to the map, there is another footpath here in the hedge. And we did find in the hedge, oh, look, there is. There is a sign. It says footpath in there. And you know when you have to kind of scramble through a hedge to get to a footpath and you realize that last thing that went through there was probably a badger that perhaps has not been a well-used path. But I've got my map. So we walk, go through the hedge, and I say, we have to go to the other end of the field and we'll find the entrance into the next field. So we march across the stubble in our sandals, which wasn't great. Get to the other corner, kind of other corner, but it's pretty overgrown. And we're standing there, I'm looking, well, the map says. And I kind of sort of stamp through the undergrowth and I shout back to Sue, I can see a gate. There is a gate. And it looks like it's not anyone being through that gate for a while. And I can see through the gate into another field. And I know there are another two fields beyond that before we can get to where we need to get to. Now, when we first pushed our way through the hedge, there was a bit of a risk. And there's something about taking risks, which is good. It's good to take risks in life. It's good to say, not sure what's going to go on here, but maybe it is worth the effort. I don't know the outcome, but this will be a good experience. And then you get to a point where you're going, I don't know where this might go, and it looks like we might get stuck in this field, and then we might have to double back. And to persist then becomes foolish. And to persist by saying, I've got a map, I know what I'm doing, and say to Sue, come on, we can push our way through this hedge, and then we can push our way through another hedge, and maybe we can do that. That becomes foolish. Because the implications of doing that are dire for me. And you then think, well, what would keep us going on that path? Is it pride? Is it a self-belief that I know what I can do this? I don't need any help. Is it the kind of reluctance to turn back and find another way? What would make us continue on that course? Well, we didn't. We came out the field and Sue said, I'll wait here, you can get the car. So so there were consequences of that as well. But so many times, we might find ourselves in situations where we're thinking, I've taken a risk, maybe I've made a mistake. Maybe I've done something not quite right here. But it's foolish to persist in that. And the foolishness is in persisting when you know that it's the wrong course of action, when a mistake will lead to further mistakes. And that foolishness then puts us in situations where it gets worse. And the son that Jesus refers to in this story that he told pushed forward in his foolishness for a while. He took the money, he went away, and then he became foolish in what he did with the money. He wasted it. And having wasted it, he then became foolish in, at that point, thinking, I can make this better somehow. I can resolve this. So he gets a job feeding pigs. But there comes a point, and Jesus put it as he came to his senses, where that foolishness then stops. And he turns around and goes in the other direction. He goes back with some humility, with a readiness to be told off or to be given something else, but a recognition that persisting and staying in that situation would be absolute foolishness. So it is a story about foolishness, but it's also a story about the redemption. Because if Jesus had an Old Testament kind of approach, that would probably have been the end of the story. That this son was foolish, and the consequence of his foolishness that he ended up feeding pigs. But there you go. That's what happens when you're foolish. But Jesus continues the story, and in fact, the heart of the story is the idea that as he returns away from his actions, even when he was a long way off, his father sees him. And his father is not waiting for apology. He's not waiting for him to show humility. He's not waiting for an explanation. He just sees his son, and that is enough. Because his compassion and his mercy is far greater than the foolishness on display. In fact, Jesus, even though he didn't preach or teach about foolishness very much, he also exhibited a huge tolerance for fools. In many ways, you can say that he brought them close to himself. There are so many times when the disciples that were close to Jesus and were chosen by Jesus acted pretty foolishly. When they didn't show great wisdom. A lot of the times they just didn't get it. Or they would say rash things. You know, some things would blurt out of their mouths. And, oh dear, you know. And in many ways, probably the disciple that, you know, illustrates that the most was Peter. Peter would be, you know, put his foot in it so many times, he's just going to dive straight in, and you think, oh, that was a bit foolish. He would say things, do things that were rash, and Jesus did more than tolerate that. So Jesus, in his response to his disciples and the foolishness they often displayed, was forgiving and loving. He did correct them. He would challenge them. He would say to them, don't you get this? He would ask them to do things that were beyond their capabilities. He would absorb some of their kind of sort of nonsense at times. But there were also times when he would put before them a truth that was difficult for them to accept and understand. Because he loved them. And with Peter, who exhibited that utter foolishness of, first of all, lashing out when Jesus was arrested, you know, expressing anger when Jesus had to calm him down, and then betraying Jesus by denying that he even knew him and swearing and lying about him, is that it was Peter that Jesus then brought back and restored and said, the foundation of the church, Peter, is going to be on you. So the entire church is based on a group of fools in many respects. People who acted foolishly, rashly, who didn't behave in ways that we would expect it from the wise and the intelligent. And in our culture, in our society, we place high value on wisdom still, on intellect, on intelligence, on education. It matters. You know, we value it greatly. But the highly educated, the intellectual, the intelligent, aren't necessarily full of love or mercy or grace. That's not where grace and love and mercy is always found. And if anything, we are living in a faith, exhibiting a faith that is in itself foolish. It's how people see us. We're fools to put our trust, our hope, our life in an unseen God. That's regarded as foolish. When a world that we live in says, is yourself that you put your faith and your hope in. Your own abilities, your own capabilities, your own status, your own wealth, your own intelligence, your own wisdom, your own kind of spirituality, whatever it is, you put it in yourself. It's seen as foolish to put your faith elsewhere. But foolishness is probably the basis of our faith. And when Paul was writing to the Corinthians, this is what he says in 1 Corinthians. He says, for the message of the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing. But to us who are being saved, it is the power of God. For it is written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise. The intelligence of the intelligent I will frustrate. Where is the wise man? Where is the scholar? Where is the philosopher of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world? For since in the wisdom of God, the world through its wisdom did not know him, God was pleased through the foolishness of what was preached to save those who believe. Jews demand miraculous signs and Greeks look for wisdom, but we preach Christ crucified, a stumbling block to Jews and foolishness to Gentiles. But to those who God has called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ the power of God and the wisdom of God, for the foolishness of God is wiser than man's wisdom, and the weakness of God is stronger than man's strength. In many ways, we're called to be foolish. And that's a paradox, isn't it? That seems strange, to be called to be foolish. But that's exactly what the gospel is a call to be fools, to believe, to be simple in what we believe. And Jesus did that consistently as he spoke to people. He made it really, really simple. Really simple. I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one could come to the Father except through me. It couldn't be simpler, but it couldn't be harder for some to accept. And for those who hold on to the belief that they know best about their lives, who hold on to their own sense of wisdom and intellect in a way that says, I can work this out myself, that ultimately is a far kind of worse foolishness than the foolishness that says, Lord, I know nothing. Without you, I am nothing. In you, I place my life, my trust, my being, because in you I have true being and purpose. That's not being clever. That's not being wise. That is being faithful to God and his calling on our lives. So let's not kind of abandon foolishness, because there is a place for it. It's at the heart of our faith. But let's give up on those foolish things where we are persistent and try to kind of push our way through that fence and that hedge again, going, on the other side it'll be better. I can make this work. I'm capable of getting this right. You'll only end up with scratches. You'll only end up standing in the field going, how did I get here? Believe. Put our faith in Jesus. That's the wisest thing to do. Amen.